The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Johnson, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is September 14, 2021. We have five cases on our calendar today, and we are here on our first matter, A210234, Woodward versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, I'm going to ask you to mute your microphone when you're not speaking. The marshal is showing a running clock of your time. Please pay attention to the clock. I'm going to ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking. These matters are being recorded, and each party will have 15 minutes for their primary argument, and the appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. With that, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Zach Longsdorf. I represent appellant John Woodward. Mr. Woodward contends that his claim should be reviewed under the interest of justice exception. The district court didn't really address the merits of Mr. Woodward's claims. However, those claims, whether in the form of a Rayner claim, a Brady claim, or an ineffective assistance of counsel claims, would have merit. During an hour-long call with Brenda Benedict, Thomas Jackson's sister, OSI Asia was told that Jackson told Benedict that she made up the allegations against Woodward. And I think that Benedict laid it out pretty clearly in her affidavit when she stated, "I told Mr. Asia that my brother Thomas Jackson told me that he, Thomas Jackson, set Woodward up to cover up a crime in which my brother Thomas Jackson committed." And then the recorded call between Asia and Benedict is similarly clear. And this is laid out in Mr. Woodward's briefs, but by the 23rd line of the transcription of that call, and that's 23rd line, not page, Benedict is telling OSI Asia that Jackson told her that he fabricated the allegations against Woodward. On pages 26 through 27 of that transcript, Asia is asking if Jackson came out and actually said that, and Benedict tells him, yeah, and then explains about the truck and money that Jackson thought he already had and how Jackson didn't care if Woodward was going to get in trouble as long as Jackson didn't. If you jump forward to pages 52 to 53 of that transcript, Benedict starts...
Mr. Longsdorf, yes. Why was your client not able to bring this claim in his first post-conviction action?
The reason that my client didn't bring this claim in his first post-conviction or on his direct appeal was, even though that the CD with this call on it was turned over to him, the importance of it was completely obscured by the report that came with it. And what happened there was that...
So what changed between the first post-conviction and the second post-conviction?
What changed between the post-convictions was that Mr. Woodward actually sold his house, but he hired a team of investigators who were all former law enforcement individuals, and they went through everything in this file, including the recording and including things that the prosecution and its agents had indicated in its reports that weren't going to be important to Mr. Woodward's case. And just the report that came with that transcript, and it was created by Krennic, who said that he got a call from OSI Asia. And then there's two paragraphs about this call. The first one is about how Krennic requested a copy of the call on a CD, got it, and then turned it over to the county attorney's office. The second paragraph says, in review of the CD,
Before we get into the substance of the statement, I guess I'm interested in the issues that are relevant to the NAFLA doctrine. And it seems to me that, I mean, he had 2 years between his conviction, or between the direct appeal and the first post-conviction petition to hire a team of investigators or whomever. So, I mean, that was an adequate opportunity, was it not, to develop that claim and make it in the first post-conviction? Why should he be allowed to bring this claim in a second post-conviction petition?
I think the reason that he should be allowed to bring it in the second post-conviction pretty closely mirrors the same reason that we believe the claim would satisfy the newly discovered evidence exception to the time bar. And the way that works is there's this evidence was disclosed, but the importance of it was concealed. And then what happens is Mr. Woodward, leading up to and during trial for 2.5 years, is incarcerated in the administrative SEG unit at Oak Park Heights. And there he's got no ability to take part in his own defense. And so that's up to 2.5 years leading up to and then slightly after trial. But after that, Mr. Woodward is unable to go through these things on his own because he's incarcerated. He doesn't have an investigator. And the language is used with that newly discovered evidence exception, which I think would apply both to the time bar and to NAFLA, is that the courts are looking for whether or not the defendant exercised due diligence in discovering the evidence and presenting the claim.
In Mr. Longstorff, can I ask a question about, you're equating the two, I'll call it standards for lack of a better word, on the NAFLA context. I think the language is whether the legal basis was reasonably available at the time of the previous appeal. That's a little bit different. That language is a little bit different than the Riley factors as they discuss due diligence or discovery of newly discovered evidence, right? Those language is a little bit different. So my question is there some Minnesota authority that equates the two or that defines reasonably available on the NAFLA doctrine side as equivalent to discovered, the meaning of the word discovered under newly discovered evidence when you're looking at the Riley factors? Or is that just an argument you're making today for us without support from another authority that equates those two things? Because those words are a little bit different.
I agree that they're a little bit different. I'm not aware of any authority that specifically equates the two of them. However, in Mr. Woodward's view, in the way we're looking at this, is the NAFLA doctrine typically applies to issues that were known but not raised or reasonably could have been raised at an earlier proceeding. And I think that it fairly closely mirrors sort of the due diligence aspect of the newly discovered evidence claim, where the courts are looking toward, did the defendant, not necessarily was it there, but could he have discovered it through the exercise of due diligence? And the way we're looking at it is sort of with the newly discovered evidence and the interest of justice is that there is this recording. We don't dispute that it was turned over, but our belief is that the importance of it was obscured to Mr. Right. Woodward's
case. And Mr. Longstorff, I just want to be clear because Judge Johnson's question was about the NAFLA doctrine, and your answer is kind of dovetailing or coming back to an analysis under newly discovered evidence and the standard we have for what newly discovered means. So you're not making some separate analysis that NAFLA is satisfied or that theoretically someone could satisfy NAFLA without satisfying the definition of newly discovered, right? You're saying they're the same thing and we should apply the newly discovered due diligence, the Riley factors to determine the NAFLA bar.
I think that's the position we're taking. And I think that if Mr. Woodward is able to satisfy the newly discovered evidence exception to overcome the time bar, then I think that those same evidence and those same factors would also justify excusing the NAFLA bar, because we would have and he would have shown that this was a claim that wasn't reasonably available to him at an earlier time and that he had exercised due diligence in finding this evidence and making the claim.
All right. So then my follow-up question is, and you've said it twice now, I think, this obscuring the information available or not being more forthcoming in the description of evidence, even though the disc itself is disclosed, you're saying that it wasn't either reasonably available under the NAFLA context or in the Riley factors, it's not newly discovered because the description of what was on that disc was not as accurate as you think it should have been. Is there any authority for defining what discovered means in the newly discovered evidence under the Riley factors, for defining that as you're putting it, inaccurately describing evidence? Or is there any authority under in the NAFLA context that would say reasonably available requires the state to not only turn over the disc, but if they are going to describe it in certain, you know, to a certain degree of accuracy? Is there any authority for that as a way of defining newly discovered evidence?
I don't know any case that says that in those same words, but there's a case cited in Mr. Woodward's brief, and the case is State v. Caldwell. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1982. And what that case involved was it was addressing a newly discovered evidence claim dealing with a witness that had been disclosed, but the way the witness was disclosed made it unclear as if the witness's importance to the defendant's case was known. And the way the Supreme Court addressed that was they said that the testimony of this alibi witness, who stated at Marjorie Caldwell's trial that she saw appellant in the hotel in Colorado on the same night the murders were committed in Duluth, could be material enough to meet the probability requirement of the Berry test for newly discovered evidence. And it goes on to say, furthermore, although appellant's counsel received a copy of the witness's statement, which then contained information unfavorable to appellant, her name did not appear on the prosecutor's list of 207 prospective witnesses. While we caution that the size of the case and the number of witnesses involved may never be used as an excuse for an inadequate investigation, we do not believe that due diligence necessarily requires defense counsel in a case of this magnitude to re-interview persons who are not listed as prospective witnesses and whose prior statements indicate they possess no information helpful or relevant to the case. And so in our view, that deals with evidence that was potentially available earlier but wasn't known to the defendant. And in under circumstances like that, I think the Supreme Court, at least in that case, had indicated that there's the possibility that such evidence can be considered newly discovered evidence. And so I think when the district court focused solely on the fact that the recording was disclosed, but ignored the way that it was disclosed and how that report that came with it, essentially, I mean, all that report said was, the second paragraph said, in review of the CD, Brenda told OSI Asia she believed Jackson was currently at, quote, Volunteers of America, end quote. Then there's an address and a phone number, or Chesapeake Incorporated, and then there's an address. And that's all that the report says about that phone call. And we believe that that really does obscure the importance of that phone call, because in it you have Brenda Benedict saying that the day my brother got out of prison, which was December 14th, and came to Baltimore, he told me, yeah, I made this up. Look, you know, that I was trying to sell this guy a truck, and then it fell apart on me, and I didn't want to get in trouble. And I think it's important to keep in mind that Jackson had been charged with fraud while he was incarcerated at Stillwater. And so I kind of turned this thing on Woodward. And then Benedict says, well, we're worried this guy's going to come after us.
Counsel, can I turn back to Judge Johnson's original question? I mean, let's assume, I'll assume for the sake of argument right now, that at the time of the disclosure, there was some obfuscation of the relevance of the testimony or the statement. And I'll also assume that your client was in segregation for some period of time while he was incarcerated. But there were years, like 5 years, between the time of his release from segregation and his second post-conviction motion where he could have reviewed this material. So I'm having a hard time getting to this, to the second part of this test of he could have the due diligence. He had time to look at this material. Are you saying that he didn't have time or didn't have the opportunity to look at it at all before he filed the second post-conviction petition?
I don't think I could say that he didn't have any opportunity to himself personally review that evidence. What I can say about it is that Mr. Woodward was incarcerated during that time. I don't believe he had the opportunity to actually look at that or to listen to the recording. And I know that the recording hadn't been transcribed until Mr. Woodward's defense team or his investigators found it and transcribed it. And that's when it was discovered. And in our view, I think that because of the...
Well, that's when the importance of it was discovered to your client, but he had the opportunity to listen to it before then, right?
He may have had the opportunity to listen to it while he was incarcerated. I guess I don't know the answer to that part of it for sure. However, I know that he didn't, and that he didn't, and the way I know he didn't is because that there was no claims based upon it. And in our view, this is evidence that if presented and if true, would truly have the ability to change the outcome of this case. And the reason for that is sort of twofold. Number one, the best evidence that Mr. Woodward would have in his defense, aside from that second call where he, or the second recording where he was saying, you know, I don't really want to do this, would be proof of Jackson admitting that he fabricated this to cover up his own attempt to swindle Mr. Woodward. And the second part is that this was a conspiracy charge, and the way that the biggest overt step that was identified here was the payment of the $2,500 that was in the trust account for Jackson's attorney. And if there actually was a truck, as Benedict said in her call with Asher, and if Jackson had been sort of badgering her to try to get it sold to him for less money because he had already sold it, that would explain that payment. So instead of being a down payment on having somebody killed, it's a payment for a truck, and that takes away the overt step toward the conspiracy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lonsdorf. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Mr. McCarthy.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Sean McCarthy with the Rice County Attorney's Office. I appear today on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. I'd like to pick up with a comment that Judge Frisch, you made with reference to the Caldwell argument about, you said that you would assume there was some obfuscation, some hiding of the importance of the information. I think it's really important to recognize that there was no hiding here. The recording has been available since before the trial, since sometime in 2011, 2012. And even if you factor in the time that the defendant was incarcerated in the program where he didn't have access to things, Your Honor nailed it. He had about 5 years in which he could have raised the issue and failed to do so. Caldwell is distinguishable from the facts before this court because in Caldwell, it was the name of a witness that wasn't listed as a potential witness. So there's no notice whatsoever to the other side. Who is that person? Why do they matter? And should we even talk to them? That's different. Here, the exact information that was needed, the recording of the conversation, was in fact provided to the appellant and his counsel at the trial level. And I credit Mr. Lonsdorf. He's openly acknowledged that. And the issue that I think the panel seems to be having a hard time with is, well, if he's had it since way back then, and even if we give him credit for this chunk when he was in this kind of special lockdown and couldn't review it, where's the excuse for not looking at this for 5 years? There simply isn't any. And whether the court applies the time bar from the statute and uses the Riley factors or the reasonably available standard, as Judge Bryan pointed out from NAFLA, under either analysis, there simply isn't a sufficient justification for the incredible passage of time here.
Mr. McCarthy, since you're bringing up those two, do you agree that they're a complete overlap, or that whether something is readily available under NAFLA is the same? I'm asking if you think there's a separate standard. If so, what's the authority for saying there is a separate standard? And if not, what's the authority for saying that they're the same?
Your Honor, I think the answer is that they have overlapping factors. Some of the things you're supposed to think about are the same in both analyses or both standards. But Your Honor nailed it at the beginning. They are separate standards that have evolved on separate paths. One is statutory, one is case law. They have different articulations of those standards. And the state's position, or rather respondent's position, is that neither of those standards is met here. If the court is looking at one or the other or focused on one or the other, I agree. You can focus on one or the other because they are different. In terms of authority for that, I can't provide the court with a case saying they're separate. This might be the case if the court wants to carve that out and clarify it for future practice. But at the moment, again, I'm not aware of any direct authority. It's more looking at the language of the standards themselves. As the court stated, reasonably available is different than newly discovered evidence and the analysis that goes there. Again, despite the overlapping factors. Another point I'd like to draw to the court's attention is with regard to the concept of whether something was hidden or unavailable. Again, I've outlined that Caldwell is clearly not applicable here because it's factually distinguishable, but That argument, as advanced by appellant, is a really key part of their argument, that somehow he didn't know to look at this recording sooner, or he didn't realize how important it was. That argument, taken to its logical extreme, would require law enforcement and prosecutors, every time they turn over evidence of some sorts, every time there's a disclosure to the defense, to have some kind of system of ranking of importance, whether it's gold stars or, hey, look at this, it's really important. And the problem with that is it invades the province of the attorney in terms of attorney work product from a law enforcement standard. Just because an officer doesn't think it's important for one thing at one particular point in time doesn't mean that defense counsel will agree or disagree with that later. The rule we have always followed, turn over the evidence and let the other side review it for themselves. That's exactly what was done here. It was turned over, and the appellant had the opportunity through his counsel prior to trial and at trial, and on his own for 5 full years after whatever things were limiting him on the front end, he had plenty of opportunity to review it, and there's no excuse for not doing it sooner.
Well, Mr. McCarthy, how far do you extend that logic? Like if something were disclosed as a disc, a CD, and there's an audio file in the disc, but the disc is labeled something that doesn't sound relevant at all. Pick whatever you want to put on there, right? It just says exhibit one, or it says nothing, an unlabeled disc, or it's labeled as something that's completely different. It's mislabeled. Are you saying that that is still readily available? Or that is still something that was initially disclosed and such that a defendant who's been in solitary is somehow understood or assumed to have knowledge of what's actually on the mislabeled or unlabeled disc?
No, Your Honor, not at all. I think the scenario that the court is suggesting could, in the right set of facts, be some kind of obfuscation or some kind of hiding, whether intentional or unintentional. The Supreme Court here, and I apologize, I'm searching for the case, but the court has already stated that it's the interpretation of the Youngblood Doctrine, which is destruction or failure to preserve evidence, that there's got to be some bad faith on top of the fact that it was destroyed or not retained properly. The same concept applies here, is if there's some kind of showing that it was done in bad faith, that would definitely be something to look more closely at and would be closer to meeting a standard. If it were just mislabeled, maybe, maybe not. It kind of depends on the facts of any particular case. What I'd submit is we don't need to have the answer to the court's direct question, Judge Bryan, because on these facts, we're nowhere close to anything like that. The entire audio recording as it was recorded on the disc was turned over. And what we have is an argument that, hey, this might not be the whole recording. Well, ultimately, the state turned over everything the state had. Does that help answer the court's question, I hope? Ultimately, the respondent would submit that in this case, the trial court, on what is essentially a fourth post-conviction petition, first one with 2 amendments, so that's 1, 2, 3, and here we are at number 4, many years past, 2 prior direct appeals. And appellant is basically asking this court to somehow find that the trial court abused its discretion by denying a hearing and by carefully reviewing. The trial court's order here is very thorough. It went through everything in the petition. It went through all the claims raised. It went through the prior petitions, and it referenced the prior decisions of the Court of Appeals. All of that is exactly what this court wants the trial courts to do, a careful, meticulous analysis of all the different factors at play. And important here is the timing is so elongated before these issues are raised when they could have, should have been raised sooner. No exception for not raising them sooner. Trial court did what it was appropriate. It did not abuse its discretion. It analyzed the questions within the scope of the facts before it. On those grounds, the respondent would ask that this court affirm the trial court's decision. Unless the court has additional questions, I think the panel seems to clearly understand the issues here. I can go on for six more minutes if you want, but I'm told that, you know, that's not always necessary.
Are there any other questions from the panel this morning?
I do have a quick question for Mr. McCarthy, and that's related to the standard of review. Both parties, I think, correctly note that typically denials of post-conviction petitions are reviewed for an abuse of discretion, but there are sometimes legal issues that we review de novo. And as I look at the Riley factors, specifically whether or not the through the petitioner's exercise of due diligence, the evidence could have been ascertained, or whether there's clear and convincing evidence that the petitioner is actually innocent, the actual innocence, the clear and convincing standard, the exercise of due diligence. Do you, Mr. McCarthy, think that those are things that we defer to the district court's analysis or decision-making, such that this is specifically on those two factors, abuse of discretion review, or is there some element of those that you think is a de novo? Can we, on our own, look at this conduct and decide if that's due diligence, or are we deferring in some way?
Your Honor, it's a little bit of a trick question, and with all due respect to the court, because to the degree it's a factual question, this court defers. To the degree it's a legal question, it's de novo. But as I think the court probably knows in the framing of the question, questions like this are very fact-specific, case-specific, and often interplay a little bit of legal, a little bit of factual. What I would submit is the appropriate standard for the court here is, if it's a factual question that the court seems to be hinging on or focused on, that's given deference. If it's a legal interpretation question, that's what this court can engage in more of a de novo review. But to the degree the two are mixed, that's the tricky part that this court deals with on a regular basis in all kinds of questions. And I can't venture to say, here's the rule you should always apply in every case. Does that help answer the court's question?
Not really. No, I'm just, it is helpful to break it out that way. And I agree with you that we may be looking at a mixed question. I think that the facts are not really disputed as much as what does that mean for our characterization of the facts or the district court's characterization of the facts? And are we reviewing that characterization or making our own characterization about what due diligence looks like? So I agree that this may be one of those mixed questions. And I'm not sure it's any more clear now than it was before I started, but I appreciate the attempt. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I can try again if you really want, but I think we'd be having a little bit of a circular discussion on that point.
I think you probably answered it correctly. It just doesn't mean that the answer is one that's easy to understand or apply.
I get that a lot, Your Honor.
Any other questions from the panel this morning? Anything else, Mr. McCarthy?
No, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, counsel. Mr. Lonsdorf, just one moment while the marshal resets the clock, and you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. I just want to touch on the Caldwell analysis a little bit. I do think that Caldwell's a lot closer in the factual basis than described by opposing counsel, and just because I think the Caldwell was a case where there was the witness was identified as part of the case. The witness wasn't on the prosecution's witness list. And then it became apparent to the defendant later that that person had information that was potentially exonerating. And I do think we have that here where Benedict was somebody that was talked to. She wasn't on the prosecution's witness list, which was one of the exhibits to to Mr. Woodward's position. And then her importance and the possibility of completely exonerating Mr. Woodward, if what she says true, became apparent later.
Do you think that the nature of her purported testimony or statement is distinguishable from what was in Caldwell? I mean, when I read the affidavit, I mean, every evidence bell and whistle goes off. I mean, there's some lack of firsthand knowledge. There's some opinion that would be impermissible. And it's just got hearsay all over that thing. So my question is if the affidavit or the statements themselves are not admissible at all, that would be different than alibi testimony that the guy was with me in a different place. That's based on the firsthand knowledge.
I do agree that there's a difference between Caldwell and the witness saying, yes, I saw this person here, and what Benedict is saying. And, you know, there's these issues of potential hearsay and, you know, they haven't been resolved because we didn't have an opportunity to do that at the district court. But even then, we can still break apart what she said because there's, you know, Benedict has got the two parts, which is that Jackson told me that he made it up and he told me why he made it up. But she also has evidence about a truck. She had a truck and you know, Jackson's trying to buy it from her. And I think that's separate from just using Jackson's own words against him in that if there is a truck and the payments for the truck, that takes away the overt step toward the conspiracy, which is an element of the crime that has to be proven. And I do just want to touch on the sort of this idea that if Mr. Woodward's correct about sort of the obfuscation of the recording, that it would require law enforcement or the prosecution to rank evidence and provide it in such a way. But I would posit there's just a difference there between disclosing evidence, but disclosing it in a way that's misleading about what's on there. In this call was an hour long, 75-page transcript. Part of what Mr. Woodward submitted was Krennic had his own call with Benedict that was recorded. And if you listen to that or read the transcript, it seems pretty clear that Krennic is trying to cut Benedict off before she can tell him what's on there or tell him what she told Azure. And then the report only says she gave an address and it has quotes. So I think there are facts there that would allow the court to make a reasonable conclusion that the intent was to mislead Mr. Woodward about that in hopes that he didn't discover it and use it at trial.
And, Monster, how is the disclosure about this particular witness different in character from the disclosure regarding the other witnesses in the case? Were the other disclosures more robust, or were they equally terse?
I don't know the answer to that, I guess, off the top of my head at this moment, Your Honor, other than this is the one that we had focused on, and it was a 75-page long call where this witness said these things over and over to Asia, and all this disclosed that she provided an address.
Well, how would it be obfuscating the importance of the testimony if all of the witnesses were described in an equally brief, with equally brief or short descriptions, incomplete descriptions?
I suppose that would be a factor that would be relevant to it. And I would note that particularly with the calls that were inculpatory, or not calls, but recordings, all those were transcribed and provided for use. This one wasn't transcribed. It's just, I mean, the only thing it says is the two addresses were just a tiny, tiny portion of that. And it's clear that Krennic had listened to it. And so I do think that there is a basis to reach that conclusion there. In the absence of any further questions, I don't have anything.
Well,
further.
If I could follow up, Mr. Longsdorf, because the argument that there was some misconduct on the part of the prosecutor in the way that this was disclosed, or the argument that defense counsel, we assume defense counsel is going to look at all the evidence, every disc, every transcript, every statement. That's what I think the standard of the legal standard that we would expect attorneys to follow. And so both arguments, whether it's a prosecutorial misconduct or it's an ineffective assistance or failure of trial counsel to meet that standard, both seem to be either the kind of thing that was already previously brought or could have been either under a misconduct theory or a ineffective assistance of counsel theory. And what is your response to why this court should not view the arguments made today as merely restating an ineffective assistance claim or merely restating prosecutorial misconduct?
I don't think they're merely restating it because it truly is based on evidence that Mr. Woodward wasn't aware of, and whether it was because the detective, sort of misled about it, or his attorney didn't go through it. Mr. Woodward didn't know this. And part of the reason why was that it was obscured. And if we're looking at the interest of justice and trying to get review and have courts look at this exonerating evidence, in our view, that's sort of an outside impediment that supports Mr. Woodward's claim for review. And we believe that he's presented a factual case here that should allow at least for an evidentiary hearing where he can present facts to support those claims. Thank you.
All right, anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Thank you, counsel, very much. The matter is submitted.